Just because I'm a winemaker doesn't mean I have to be a critic all the time.
Oh, this is fun and it's beautiful. You do it because you love it. And if you don't love it unconditionally and stupidly and you're not crazy passionate about it, you won't last.
You know, to stay out of the vineyard, I only have the shotgun for the boar and I'm thinking, great.
Turning sugar into alcohol is not really rocket science.
You think your car depreciates quickly. Don't hold a candle to what barrels do.
A lot of people don't realize Sonoma County is 1 million acres. Makes us about the size of Rhode Island as a state.
I mean, in my youth, my first couple of vintages, the crazy part was being lucky we're alive still.
The really cool thing about wine is it swims in the stream of history and civilization and everything else.
I worked 14 hours the day before I went into labor. I was determined to get most of that Chardonnay in.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 228. This week we feature Laura Barrett of Cliff Family Winery in Napa Valley.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Every wine tells a story. Each growing season, it's our goal to create an artisan Napa Valley wine of exceptional quality. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
Rosé, Cabernet, Pinot, Gewürztraminer. All are a pleasant take-along for a nice long bike ride and picnic. Cliff Family Winery knows all about bike rides. Cliff Family is owned by Gary Erickson and Kit Crawford, best known for the famous Cliff Bar. Laura Barrett is the winemaker for Cliff, and we managed to catch up with her at the tasting room, Velo Vino, in the heart of Napa Valley.
We're here at Laura Barrett, and we're at the Cliff Family Tasting Room, which is better known as
Velo Vino.
Right. And Laura is the winemaker for Cliff Family. And our listeners may remember a few years ago, we spoke with Bruce Regalia, the previous winemaker, and now we're back to follow up, which is great. And we originally met you, Laura, at auction last year, I believe.
Yes, 2016.
Right.
Correct.
And how long have you been winemaker here?
I have been the winemaker here since November of 2014. I came on board right after harvest, so when I started, I inherited the 2013 vintage in barrel, and the 2014 vintage just either still in tank or freshly barreled down. So my first harvest from grape to bottle was really 2015.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, that's got to give you a little bit of pride, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And it was a great time to start. It seemed intimidating at the time because there was a lot going on that was still a lot of moving pieces, but when I look back, I realize that I had an entire year to learn the vineyards and be fully involved in the growing season before I harvested any grapes. So it was actually a really great time to start a winemaking position.
Jumping in, especially at certain times of the year, can be crazy.
It can be, yeah.
How long have you been a winemaker?
I had my first head winemaking title in 2008 vintage, but prior to that, I was the assistant and associate winemaker at Fisher Vineyards for 5 years. So I would say my winemaking experiences began in 2003.
Okay, so you've had 10 years under your belt.
Yes.
And to me, you appear very young, so that's pretty cool to be able to get that start at that point in your life because you have millions of vintages ahead of you. you do. I mean, you do have quite a few ahead of you still, which is pretty amazing.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So you're talking about, what, 11, 12 vintages now that you've done?
13, 14, yeah, 12 vintages.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
So, well, and I always say as a winemaker that we only get one chance per year, so it actually doesn't even really feel like a lot. So a winemaker who has been in the industry for 30 years has only made wine 30 times, which I think is a small amount of sort of real hands-on physical experience. So I always talk about how I really believe that we have to remember everything about every vintage and really learn from our experience and make the most of it. I've done two vintages in the Southern Hemisphere as well, so that adds on that harvest experience. One in New Zealand and one on the west coast of Australia in the Margaret River wine region.
That must have been fun.
Oh, that was amazing. Yeah. That was one. It is one of the most beautiful places on Earth, and so few people, and the people that are there are so friendly and fun, and it was a really, really great time.
Oh, that's nice. That's very cool. And it's such a unique place, but with some tremendous wine being made there, obviously, too.
Yes.
What year did you do that?
That was the winter of 2004.
Okay, so very early in your career, which is typical of a lot of winemakers.
Yes, yes.
Have you ever tried to or considered the idea of going to Europe at this point, or is that just down the road maybe?
At this point, well, that's probably one of the areas of regret that I have. I wish I would have done it earlier before I settled into a long-term position. I mean, a European harvest for a California winemaker is a very difficult thing to do unless you're in between jobs or with a company that is willing to part with you for the most important part of the season, which is probably very unlikely.
Much bigger to not be here. That's a little bit out of the question, I imagine, from time to time.
Yes.
But considering, you know, you have so many vintages behind you now, and you started at Fisher, and did you go right to Clif then? Or?
No, no. After Fisher Vineyards, I took a winemaking position for a brand called Casey Flat Ranch, and it was a new project based out of the Capay Valley, which is in the Yolo County. And it's actually only about 25 miles from here as the crow flies, but it's up and over the county line, just over the county line at about 2,000 foot elevation. And it was a family from Marin that planted a 22-acre vineyard out there. So I made their wines for 8 years.
Wow.
Yes.
You've got a lot of experience behind you.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Well, and again, that, you know, to come into a place like Clif Family, which has obviously got a very strong reputation, so that's stepping into some pretty good sized shoes.
Yeah, absolutely. And then one of the things that I love about this position is that we make so many different varietals. So coming on board, there were varietals that I had never worked with before, so that's been a really great learning experience for me, and it keeps me interested and busy and excited about everything that we're doing here.
What were the varietals you hadn't worked with?
Gewürztraminer was the first.
Oh, yeah, there you
and
go.
And now I have this passion for Gewürztraminer. So that first year that I was learning in 2014, the end of 2014 and all of 15 before harvest, I was tasting and talking to a lot of people and trying to figure out what my approach was going to be. So my first vintage was the 15 Gewürz in bottle. Made only about 220 cases. It was a light year. And people loved the wine. It's a dry style, so very little to no residual sugar left. And the 16 is I think even better. So it's been a varietal that I've fallen in love with pretty quickly.
What I'm curious about is when you're going into a new varietal like that, obviously, I'm sure there's a certain amount of trepidation, but do you seek out advice from any other winemakers? I mean, it's not like you go to the recipe book and go through that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first thing I started to do was call all of my friends who I knew had any experience with it. And the first thing that led to was changing of the vineyard source immediately.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
One quick visit out to the vineyard, and I knew that we could do better. And I had some friends that were making some Gewürztraminer in Anderson Valley, so I called them, and that led me to a new grape contract with a really great, fantastic grower almost in downtown Boonville called Farrington Vineyards. So we're now sourcing from them, and then also conversations about winemaking style, you know, how much sugar to leave behind. Gewürztraminer is naturally a grape varietal that has very little acid. So, you know, handling that. It's also a varietal that has a lot of protein instability. So managing that. So these are all things about the varietal that I don't necessarily know just from tasting wines off the shelf. Sure. So having those conversations was a really important part of my learning curve.
Do you get a chance to go up there very often?
Yeah, yes, I go up regularly. This time of year, obviously not at all, but probably starting in the late spring, I go up about once a month, and then as we get into the ripening phase, I'm up there, I try to be up there once a week, and it's a long haul. We have two other stops along the way in Mendocino County, so I do a loop through Mendocino, and it's a long day, but it's a nice ride, and I can at least hit all three vineyards at the same time. So
yeah, that's a pretty full day. I didn't know they were growing Gewurz up there.
There's a fair amount of Gewurz up there. I think as the years go on, there's less and less, and the vineyard manager that I work for talks a lot about how there used to be so much, and they really feel passionate about what they have left. Because they know that it's kind of a fading grape varietal up there, and it's been replaced with Pinot Noir, which can fetch a much higher price point, and a lot of people doing single vineyard bottlings of Pinot Noir from Farrington Vineyards, so there is that competition. But I do think that the vineyard manager feels passionate enough about it that they're going to leave it in the ground for us for sure.
Good.
And they feel really good about my passion as well, and how excited we are about it, and how it, you know, the meaning that it has in our portfolio, because it has become kind of a powerful piece of our wine club. And when it releases, people are really excited about it and excited to try it.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Are there any other grapes that you haven't done yet? Any other varietal that you'd like to tackle that is kind of on your bucket list, if you will?
I have never worked with Pinot Noir.
You're kidding me, really? How ironic.
True, yeah.
Seeing how we're talking about
it. Yes, I know. I have never made a Pinot Noir. I think I've crushed some during a harvest in Western Australia, but I've never made Pinot Noir.
Considering how many years you've been doing this, that is a bit of a surprise.
I know. Yeah. I've worked for brands that it hasn't been a prominent part of their portfolio. Grenache has been that varietal for both wineries that I've, both Casey Flat Ranch and Cliff Family Winery. Grenache is that sort of lighter style red wine. So there's been no real draw to produce a Pinot Noir, because our Grenache is popular and well liked.
On the other hand, you never know, things could change one day.
Things could change, absolutely.
I mean, do you think that's possible that, and not that I'm talking about your business plan here, but that they would consider sourcing from elsewhere to go after doing Pinot? Especially considering it is ridiculously popular.
I think our proximity to Pinot Noir at Farrington Vineyard and our relationship with our Mendocino growers is a sure possibility. But in the wine program, it's not something that we really need at the moment. Okay. So should we expand and be looking for another varietal, I think that would definitely be something that is discussed. But the team here is pushing me to make a sweet, sexy white dessert wine. That's where we're headed next.
I respect that.
Because that is not in the program. I make a port.
Do you really?
We make port, and this was the first time I had worked with port. That was my other varietal. That was a new adventure for me. So now I just bottled 150 cases of our first port ever.
That's a pretty fair amount, too.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, it will go into Wine Club. We also have, then I have three vintages in barrel as well. So that's been a really fun learning experience as well. Really exciting, and gave me a chance to play around with the chemistry of how I want to fortify and when I want to fortify. And so it's been fun. I've learned a lot.
As far as the dessert wine, are you talking Sauvignon Blanc or something else?
Yeah, I think Sauvignon Blanc would probably be the go-to grape for that.
Yeah, very popular around here, obviously, but boy, it makes such a beautiful dessert wine.
It does. Yeah. It does. And it would be a nice follow-through with our Sauvignon Blanc wine program here, because that's a big percentage of our case production is Sauvignon Blanc.
Now, interesting question here for you. Seeing how we're talking about port and we're talking about a late harvest Sauvignon Blanc, I know you don't work here in the tasting room, but how do you talk to somebody who comes to you and says, I just don't like those sweet wines? I mean, I'm a lover of dessert wines, but how do you tell somebody as a winemaker that this is something you shouldn't miss?
Well, I think here at Cliff Family Winery, we have the opportunity to bring food into everything that we do. So if I were behind the tasting bar, I think that I would convince someone to taste a dessert wine by offering a pairing. It's a very easy way to say, well, here, even though you think you might not like it, try it with this. And, you know, we've done the work for you, so we know these two things go well together. And we can, you know, assure you that it's a match made in heaven, you know.
Okay, maybe you should spend more time at the tasting room.
Yeah, because we deal with that with the Gewürztraminer. People say, oh, no, I don't like that. It's sweet. No, it's not sweet. You must try it. And then people love it. So food is a really, really easy way to get people to try new things.
Yeah, without a doubt, wine lovers love to turn people on to other wines. This is just a bit of a tougher nut to crack, isn't it, with the dessert wine area?
Yeah, I think so. I think because people aren't used to consuming it on a regular basis and in any sort of volume. I think when your sort of average consumer sits down, they want a glass of wine and they want it to be refreshing or rich, you know, whether it's white or red. They have expectations of what they want. Sure. So with a dessert wine where it's a shorter pour and it's meant to, you know, sort of finish off a meal, it's a dessert wine to me is more part of an experience as a whole. So for someone that's just coming in to taste and they might want to purchase a couple of bottles to take away, dessert wine might not be what they're after. But you have to teach them how to incorporate that as part of the experience. And that's what we're really good at here. I mean, we're you know, we want to create authentic experiences for people, ones that are memorable and ones that they can kind of take away and repeat at their dinner table. Or, you know, we have our whole line of Clif Family Kitchens products as well that we incorporate into our tasting experiences so they can purchase that and take it home and kind of repeat or, you know, in their entertaining.
Sure.
Yeah.
So one of the things I like when we walk into the store here, and I've always loved this store, the wood, the look of it, it's just a wonderful space. And of course, the tie-in with biking. But pink, oh my gosh. Rosé is huge with you guys. Tell me about your rosé.
Yes, our rosé program has been really exciting and really hot and just something that now we look forward to every February. So I source our Grenache for rosé in Mendocino County. And it's a block that we harvest especially for rosé. So there are two ways that we can make rosé in the winery. One is actually picking the grapes at a lower Brix level, lower sugar, and pressing them immediately and making it like a white wine. The alternative way is to pull juice off of a red fermenter, sort of as a byproduct of a red wine, and that tends to be pink because it hasn't been sitting on the skins for too long. And make rosé from that. So my preferred method is the white wine making style where we actually harvest the grapes between 22 and 23 and a half Brix, yields a wine with lower alcohol and higher acid. So we made our very first rosé of Grenache in 2014, and there were very few cases. It was only about 115 cases, but people loved it. It was extremely pale pink. I mean, the color is barely pink. Yeah. And that's just the nature of the varietal. Grenache is a grape that has very little pigment, so to get even a pale pink it takes a lot of effort. So I pick the grapes low sugar, direct to press, and I do a little bit of skin contact. So not necessarily for color, because I've learned that it doesn't help me in that department. I do it for mouthfeel and flavor. It gives it just a little bit of texture and tannin on the mid palate. And then we age for 4 months in 100% stainless steel barrels and then bottle in January. So by February 15th, we are ready to roll. And this winter hasn't been so accommodating for rosé wine drinking. It's been raining nonstop, but we're still really excited to have it on the shelf. And now last year we made 250 cases and it was gone in about 3 weeks. So this year we bottled 500 cases. So people are really excited just to get their hands on it this year so that they know they can, they're guaranteed to have it for summer drinking.
What are you selling that for?
It's $26 a bottle.
It's a good price.
Yeah.
Good price point for now.
Yeah. Well, this rosé is extremely fruit-driven. It's a fruit bomb on the nose. It's watermelon and, you know, it goes into that sort of ripe pear category. And this particular vintage has a lot of acidity. It's and it's really well balanced by that little bit of tannin and a tiny, tiny bit of residual sugar, not enough to taste sweet at all, but just enough to give it a little bit more richness on the palate. So it's a great wine just for summer sipping on a hot day, but it's also a really great food wine because it does have this searing acidity. So we're really excited about the rosé program, and it's just a matter of getting our hands on more grapes. I mean, Grenache is a varietal that is really difficult to find. In Napa Valley, there's very little Grenache. So we have some good relationships with our growers in Mendocino, and we hope that we can continue to meet the demand.
Nice. That's great. Any interesting stories? And I mean, you've got a lot of experience behind you now. Any experience you could talk about that was kind of like, boy, that was silly, or wow, I'm glad I survived it?
Yeah, absolutely. One jumps to mind. And it was during my first harvest as an assistant winemaker. No, actually, I was not an assistant winemaker yet. It was my first year at Fisher Vineyard, so I was still an intern. But I didn't have a lot of cellar experience. I had more lab experience and a little bit of vineyard experience. And, of course, my master's degree in viticulture and enology I had just finished. But I didn't have a lot of hands-on cellar experience. So we were working on the crush pad, and we were finishing for the day, and we were pushing the red grapes that were in the 3-inch must pump, must line, back into the tank, and we did that. We pushed with water, and then I broke the seal where the must line met the pump, but I had forgotten to do one very, very important thing, which was to check that the must line was not submerged into the tank, into the grapes. So when I broke the line and the reverse siphon started and the water came gushing down, which is what I expected, and I thought I was draining the line, but then grapes started coming out. And I had no idea what was happening. I just knew that there were grapes gushing out of the must line onto the crush pad, which is not where we wanted them.
No.
And thankfully, there was someone there that went, you know, just ran upstairs and pulled the line out of the tank. And so I just kind of stood there in awe and was frustrated and said, I just don't think I have enough experience to be doing this. And the winemaker that I was working with at the time, Whitney Fisher, said to me, you know, this is it. This is your experience. You're gaining it right now. You just learned something. You will never do that again. And so it was kind of a nice moment where I had really made a terrible mistake, but at the same time, it was a really good learning experience. And it was a moment where I knew that the only way I was going to learn was by doing it and work harder and work longer and get your hands dirty and move more wine. And that's how you figure it out.
Sure. We all learn from mistakes. It's just with winemaking, it can be a little scarier.
Catastrophic.
Yeah. That you don't want. For our listeners who'd like to learn a little bit more about you and a little more about Cliff Family Wines, how would they do that online?
They would go to www.clifffamily.com, and please remember that Cliff has one F.
Laura, thanks for taking the time to come down to the tasting room and meet with us and talk today. It's been fun chatting with you.
Thank you for coming.
Learn more by visiting clifffamily.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Every wine tells a story. Each growing season, it's our goal to create an artisan Napa Valley wine of exceptional quality. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2017.